Welcome to the Cascadian Prophets Podcast, a production of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, empowering people to practice poetry and deepen connections to place, self, and the present moment.
And now we present part two of our October 22, 2023 interview with poet Robert Bringhurst.
You're renowned for your connection to the indigenous cultures of British Columbia. Can you talk about how indigenous culture informs this poem and your poetry in general? I mean, obviously, the translation books, that's very clearly a translation of Haida culture, but how does that information get expressed in your poetry work?
When I was very young, I had Navajo friends and Cree friends, but like all the friendships of my early years, these were fairly transitory experiences. And then, you know, I eventually became a student of literature, and so I studied, as we do in North America, English literature, French literature, some Spanish literature, then as we do on the West Coast, some Chinese and some Japanese and some Sanskrit and some Greek and Latin. I took lessons from Ezra Pound, who I never met, but who was a schoolmaster at heart and who had a lot of things to say about what young poets needed to read and how they needed to read it. And it dawned on me at some point that the land I was born in, the continent I was born in, didn't appear in this map of the literary world. It was as if there were no Native American culture, no Native American literature, and I knew this to be false. Nowadays, it's a big thing in the schools, the recognition, the acknowledgement of the indigenous presence, but in my childhood, it was absolutely invisible. So it was only by virtue of some friendships with Native people, which were important to my father and to me, I was aware that there was any indigenous culture here. Still, I knew essentially nothing about it because I was a bookish kid, and it never appeared in the books that I read. Well, of course, there were books, but I just, neither Ezra Pound nor anybody else on whom I was dependent for advice ever suggested that I look at these books. When I moved to the West Coast to go to grad school, I knew that I was entering a new world. I didn't know the plants and the animals the way I would have if I'd been born here, grown up on the well, I was born on the West Coast, but in California, and I was taken away from there before my first birthday, so I remembered nothing of Los Angeles. I was coming to the West Coast as if for the first time, and I was experiencing the West Coast forests and the mountains and the rivers for, as it were, the first time. So as part of that, I bought a bunch of guidebooks, and I went hiking with great frequency, and I carried the books around, and I learned to identify mosses and lichens and trees and flowering plants and insects and birds and to get my bearings in this place. And I also went to the library and read the anthropology of this place. So I found myself reading Franz Boas and John Swanson and Edward Sapir, and these people became heroes to me, people whose names I had not even known before I got here. That reveals a fault in my linguistic education. Chomsky was certainly not unaware of Edward Sapir, but he never mentioned Sapir because Sapir was not central to his own research. He became absolutely central to my world. Sapir was a landmark humanist among the linguists. He was perhaps the most talented linguist, professional linguist who ever lived. Brilliant man, but also, you know, a man who read and wrote poetry and who understood the people he met and the people he worked with as linguistic informants. He understood them to be human beings who had lives and stories and cultures, and he wrote about these things with great intelligence. Well, so I started reading Sapir's work, most of which was unpublished at that point, and Franz Boas's work, which was voluminously published, and John Swanton's work. Swanton was a student of Boas, and he came up here to the West Coast as a young man and spent a year with the Haida people living in both Skidigut and Masset. And of all of them, I think Swanton was the best listener. Boas was always in a hurry. Boas was passionate about his work, but until very late in his life, he wouldn't sit down long enough to let somebody tell him a really long story. The great stories are long. Oral literature is not in a hurry. It does. It wants time, and it's an old person's art. You know, you spend a lifetime becoming a myth teller. It isn't something you're going to make yourself famous as a 17-year-old romantic, and then you're going to die at 22 and be famous for the rest of your death. It's an old person's art, and Swanton just implicitly understood this, and he had a kind of transparency because he wasn't agitated the way Boas was. Swanton met some of the greatest poets I've ever read, and they were people I'd never heard of, and they were people that my literature teachers had never heard of, and they should have heard of them. Swanton met an old man named Sky, and an old man named Kilhaugens, and an old man named Hyas, and an old man named King Aguau. And Sky, in particular, was a great poet. And he met a younger man named Gandl, who was a remarkable poet. And he arranged for these poets to speak poems, to tell stories to other Haida listeners, younger Haida, younger than themselves. And Swanton sat at the side. Boas was always saying, tell a story to me. Well, people complied often enough, but they were telling the story to an outsider. Outsiders are stupid. They don't know the stuff that insiders know. And so the storytellers would leave things out of the stories they told to Boas, or they would put in explanations that didn't really belong there. Swanton arranged for himself to be perched at the side of this process and for the literature to come alive in its own
context.
In its own context, exactly. And it worked. It worked marvelously. So I was reading Swanton's English translations of these stories, and I began to see shapes in them that were just sort of barely visible in the translations, and I thought, you know, better look at the originals in these things. Swanton had problems with the Bureau of American Ethnology, which was his employer for basically his whole life, and they published only a tiny fraction of his Haida work in the original. So there were some Haida texts that I had access to. They were printed in the books, but most of the Haida stuff was still in manuscript, typescript, sitting in a museum in Philadelphia, library in Philadelphia. And, well, I began to believe that this stuff was really quite essential to my education, and that it was central to understanding what North American literature and culture might be. Of course, it was just one language out of a couple of hundred, but it was a rich tradition, because the Haida were rich. They had a fine life in a fine place, and they had time for big visual art, those poles, those carvings, those house screens, those house fronts, and for intricate little pieces, carvings, paintings, painted boxes. Anybody who's ever spent one day looking at Native American visual art will have seen art from the Northwest Coast and been especially impressed by it. People had, like people in Tuscany in the Renaissance, they had time and material, and they could make big, beautiful things, and they did. And there was a literature to go with this, and Swanson got there in time to hear it from people who could really do it. Well, so this opened up a whole world to me, and I began to move from Haida into some of the neighboring languages, Kwakwala and Uchanalt, and some other things, and I started trying to make a map of Native American literatures as a whole, all the literary works, traditions that had been recorded in some genuine way, that is, somebody had transcribed the words of an actual Native myth teller, an oral poet, speaking in his or her own language, not somebody's vague impression of in English of what somebody said in something else, in Crow or Lakota or whatever, but real texts. And I discovered that there was an enormous library of this stuff. There were thousands of pages of manuscript. There were some audio recordings, some even from very early in the 20th century, and always very brief, but sometimes still audible. And then there were long recordings from toward the end of the 20th century, when people had recording devices that didn't run out of steam after 3 minutes. And that, I should have known about this when I was born. It should have been part of my education, as much as, at least as much as Greek and Latin and Chinese. But it wasn't. So I had some catching up to do, and I dived into it and been swimming in that ocean ever since.
I want to go to the book now and ask you about the phrase moral knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and its relation to poetry. Part 7 of the poem, page 111. Yeah, you can start right from the top of the page if you'd be interested in reading two or three stanzas.
What I mean by moral knowledge is visceral on principle and not theoretical knowledge. Understanding in the gut that reaches all the way into the sizzling blizzard of ash and the shattered combustible heart of the forest, and all the way out to the self-immolating stars. It is a kind of poetry, this knowledge. There is nothing you can do with it except what you can always do with knowledge and with beauty. You can cradle them like water in your body and your mind, and let them hold you also in the palm of all your senses, Moral knowledge is a fragrance that the mind sometimes gives off, like shore pine, Nootka rose, or sweetgrass in the sun. It is the transcendental scent of simply seeing how it is.
It seems to me those two last two subjects are very related. There was a kind of moral knowledge coming from indigenous people that you felt you should have known when you were a boy.
I should have. We, you know, I mean, when I was a kid, it was as if history began with the Mayflower, you know. The racism, the stupidity, the deliberate ignorance that was built into the education I received as a young person was not apparently intentional, but it was absolutely rock solid. There was no chink in it. The truth, as far as my teachers were concerned, was that Europeans came to North America and they colonized it. They built farms and they built roads and they built factories and they built airliners and airports and they made the world, which they called the New World. Well, all those things happened, all right, that's true enough, but what about the rest of the truth? If you grow up in a city, it's easy enough to understand why your attention should be focused on the city. It's your environment, and the people who built the city are your ancestors, if not genetically, at least morally, spiritually, socially. If you grow up in the country, as I did, the incidental colonists are not, in fact, your ancestors. This country's been inhabited for tens of thousands of years, and there are people who know the trees, the rocks, the rivers, in the way you can only know them if you grow up among them and spend your life paying attention to them. And that knowledge finds its way into literature. And if you silence that literature, if you ignore it, well, there's a sense in which life based on that kind of ignorance is impossible. You can't live a real life by pretending that nobody knows anything about this country, that it was just discovered yesterday, that this is called Mount Seymour because we named it that. It didn't have any name before that because there were no people here. Once I was visiting in England, and I was introduced to a woman who had just retired as the headmistress of a prestigious girls' school. I don't remember the name of the school, but some hotshot place where the children of privileged families would go. And she asked me what languages I spoke, and I said, you know, a little English, a little French, a little Spanish, some Haida, some Navajo. And she said, Haida, Navajo, what are those? And I said, well, they're Native American languages. She didn't know what Native American might mean, so I said, they're Red Indian languages. Oh, she said, did they have languages? That's the kind of ignorance that I grew up in myself. I didn't go to a prestigious girls' school or a prestigious any other kind of school, but this woman was, in a sense, very articulate about her own ignorance. She was an educated English person, skilled at speaking, and she knew exactly where the edge of her knowledge was and that there was nothing beyond it. Did they have languages? This woman was a school teacher her whole life. She was in charge of the work of a bunch of other school teachers, paid good salaries by school teacher standards, teaching the children of the privileged people of a privileged country. And she did not know that all human beings have languages. All human beings. She knew that there were Red Indians, or that there had been in Red Indians. She perhaps didn't know that any still were alive, but she heard about Red Indians. They showed up in cowboy and Indian novels, which perhaps she had never read, but she knew they existed. And they showed up in Lone Ranger movies, which she'd probably never seen, but she knew they existed too. How could we do this to ourselves? How could we create a culture in which the roots of the world are made completely invisible? So invisible that a professional educator does not know the most basic facts about the human species. It's like not knowing about the circulation of the blood. It's like not knowing what urine and feces are, to not know that all human beings have languages. How could a professional educator in the richest culture that the world has ever seen not know that all human beings have languages, and that therefore there is the potential for literature in all human societies? And indeed, some people take a very narrow view of literature and think if you don't have writers, you don't have literature. But most of human societies, of course, over the last 200,000 years, have been entirely without writing. They didn't have it and they didn't need it. Literature is what is so important to people that they save it. It's the words that are really worth saving. And those words, if they're worth saving, know something. They have something to tell anyone willing to listen. And every school teacher everywhere should know that human beings are human. To not know that all human beings have languages is to not know that human beings are human. It's to not know what a human being is. Well, how can you be an educator if you're in that fix?
Could also explain how we treat certain types of people the way that we do.
It could, yeah. Could explain why we think, they aren't really human, so it's okay if we mow them all down with machine guns or just leave them to starve for whatever.
Is poetry that's not interested in moral knowledge a kind of parlor game?
Well, there are a lot of kinds of games. I think we can't get very far by trying to draw hard lines and saying, this kind of poetry is no good and this kind of poetry is always good. It's never like that. But a poet who is not interested in moral knowledge is probably a poet who doesn't have a lot to tell me or anybody else. The games can be fun. Word games can be fun. Are word games really a form of poetry? An incidental form, perhaps. I don't know. But not a form that matters very much. On the other hand, there's a sense in which all poetry comes close to word games. That is, you put sounds together and they have meanings, and also they are the sounds they are. The same way that oil paintings are made out of paint. Well, that's not a transformative realization that paintings are made out of paint, but it has played a role in the history of art. The easy answer to your question is yes. Poetry that's not interested in moral knowledge is parlor game, but that's only partially true. Like everything else that you might say about literature in three or four words is partially true. Literature is a big, complex, biological and ecological phenomenon, and you can't say anything really true about it unless you acknowledge that it is a very large, very complicated, very, very sophisticated, very supple, and mutable, and perishable ecosystem.
This has been part two of a three-part interview conducted with Robert Bringhurst on Sunday, October 22nd, 2023. Cascadian Profit supporters include Diana Elser, a sponsorship dedicated to her parents, whose practicality, humor, and love of family life reflected their experience in and love for the Missouri Breaks and Ruby Valley, Montana landscapes that define their childhoods. And Steinbrook Native Gallery, located near Pike Place Market in downtown Seattle, featuring fine art of the Northwest Coast from emerging and established artists. A link to their site at cascadianprofits.org. Cascadian Profits is a project of the Cascadia Poetics Lab in Seattle, Washington. Check us out online at cascadiapoeticslab.org.